Well, fascinating with Mr. Sauter. And now up next, Robert Hastings. We will be talking about a former U.S. Atomic Energy Commissioner and supervisor about revelations about Roswell and that incident. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Hastings, UFO researcher, lecturer. He has researched declassified U.S. government documents confirming UFO incursions at nuclear weapons sites occurring as early as 1948. Robert has interviewed nearly 100 U.S. Air Force veterans who were involved in nuclear weapons-related UFO incidents as well. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Robert, good morning. How are you?
Thank you for having me. Almost awake.
We'll get you. 1 hour. It's quick.
Okay.
You've done some work with into Chet Lightholz, the former U.S. Atomic Energy Commissioner. Tell me about this.
Well, in 1990, I was introduced to Chet Lightholz by Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt, who, of course, are two of the best well-known Roswell researchers. Mm-hmm. And in the course of a group dinner in Albuquerque, Mr. Lightholz, who during World War II worked on the Manhattan Project, the atomic bomb project, and later did a number of classified things for various departments and agencies within the U.S. government, including the Atomic Energy Commission, leaned over to me and just more or less said, I'm aware of certain nuclear weapons-related UFO incidents. He had obviously been tipped off that that was my specialty. Presumably Kevin Randall or Don Schmidt told him about that. In any case, I took the opportunity to ask him to elaborate and ask him if he would be willing to be formally interviewed on the record, and he suddenly backtracked and said, no, I still have contracts with the government here in Albuquerque, my company, and I just don't want to rock the boat. So that's where the matter lay for 5 or 6 years and or longer, and finally in September of 1998, I talked him into finally sitting down with me, and we did a two-hour taped interview during which he said some very amazing things.
Did he tell you much about his background?
That was already a matter of record. I knew on this two-hour tape I have references to him having done work for the Central Intelligence Agency during the Cuban Missile Crisis. His company manufactured some underwater munition lockers that were used to store weapons for the anti-Castro Cubans, very sensitive stuff. He also worked on radar development in the 1950s. He also worked on autopilot design, and he told me that he possessed copyrights or patents, I guess the term would be, for an atomic or a nuclear reactor system that was to be fitted on one of our strategic bombers back in the 50s. That project was abandoned for various reasons, but he had his fingers in just about everything. The Manhattan Project, in particular, the creation of the first atomic bomb, his company, Lytle Engineering, created what were called lenses, high explosive charges that were symmetrically placed around the plutonium core of the bomb that was exploded down in Alamogordo, a tower-mounted device. And these lenses were electronically detonated simultaneously to cause the two halves of the plutonium core to fuse together to create the critical mass, which in turn created the first atomic explosion in the world. So he was involved with some, you know, revolutionary types of projects for the U.S. government over time.
All right, some of the things that he was revealing to you on tape, did they startle you at all, Robert?
Well, I have to say yes. And before we get into the Roswell material, he told me, for example, that he and a gentleman named General Kenner Hertford, who was the deputy director of the Armed Forces Special Weapons Project here at Kirtland Air Force Base, Sandia Labs, in the early 50s, Lytle and General Hertford were out on the runway at Kirtland Air Force Base one night watching a bomb being loaded, an atomic bomb being loaded onto a bomber, which was then flown to the Nevada test site for a test detonation. And he said as they were watching this operation, they both noticed these three bright lights in the sky south of the base near the Manzano Mountains. General Hertford ran into a building and got, he was looking for binoculars, but ended up with what's called a theodolite. It's a technical telescope. And both he and Lytle looked through the telescope and saw what Chet Lytle called a saucer-shaped object, a disc-shaped object with a central dome structure. And there were three of those apparently identical side by side. And, you know, this was, the general said, this is top secret, don't discuss it with anyone. So that was one of the incidents. Lytle also told me that up at the Nevada test site during the frequent nuclear tests during the 1950s, the atmospheric tests that were being conducted up there, that a number of the photographic aircraft pilots employed by EG&G Corporation, who were contracted to all the films anyone has ever seen of atomic bombs going off in the deserts of Nevada, they were taken by EG&G Corporation. Lytle told me that a number of pilots had repeatedly sighted UFOs in the test areas just prior to the detonations. I have independent confirmation from of that from other military people, ex-military people. But so he had some pretty dramatic things to say, yes, involving UFO activity. He also happened to mention that while he was doing advanced radar experiment or engineering down at White Sands in southern New Mexico, that UFOs would come in and traveling like Mach 3, 4, and 5. That's Mach 5 would be roughly 3,500 miles per hour. Lytle said that these things would fly in out of nowhere at these unbelievable speeds and then instantaneously stop and hover and just freak everybody out on the ground when tracking these things. They were flying, you know, several times faster than any known aircraft on Earth at the time. So Lytle was involved in some extremely dramatic incidents or aware of them secondhand by virtue of his position with the Atomic Energy Commission and other classified projects.
Robert, any reason to doubt him?
None whatsoever. And Kevin Randall can tell you this, or Don Schmidt, if you choose to have them on. His record speaks for itself. I walked into his office where I interviewed him. I've never seen so many plaques on any one given office wall from various agencies and departments of the U.S. government that were, you know, lauding his company's engineering efforts for one project or another. His track record was impeccable. I have to add on a personal level that, you know, after he sort of hinted that he had some dramatic information, he at the same time decided or thought better of it, and it took me several years before he decided to go on the record. So this was not somebody who was gushing information with abandon. He was very careful about what he said, and in a few minutes, I'll tell you how this all came out. There were consequences for his ultimately being candid with me.
And he's no longer with us, right?
He passed in 2004, and I've since tried to follow up with his son. In my book, UFOs and Nukes, I have quite a bit of information about Chet Lytle, and I wanted his son to confirm it and to verify it, and he reviewed it, but he backed off because of certain events that took place after Lytle spoke with me.
What did Lytle learn about Roswell, and how did he learn about it?
Well, this came at me out of the blue. It was toward the end of the interview, and we were talking about the types of incidents, the incidents that I mentioned a moment ago. And he basically, out of the blue, said, I heard directly from William Blanchard that the Roswell object was, in fact, a recovered alien spaceship. And that got my attention. And I asked for the details, and he said that in February of 1953, he was at that time a supervisor with the Atomic Energy Commission involved in weapons stockpiling. He was involved in the supervision of the transfer of weapons from weapons storage areas to our frontline bases where they were being loaded on atomic bombers and being prepared for potential war with the Soviets. In any case, in February of 1953, he was in Alaska at Eielson Air Force Base. At the time, William Blanchard, who was the former base commander of Roswell Army Airfield during the Roswell incident, he by that time had been promoted to Brigadier General in the U.S. Air Force. His job with Strategic Air Command, 8th Air Force, was to supervise the training of bomber crews, B-36, our strategic bomber crews up at Eielson Air Force Base in Alaska. So their paths crossed up there. Lytle told me that at the same time, his wife was giving birth to his son, Chet Lytle Jr., in Chicago, and he was frantic to get back to Chicago. He said that General Blanchard offered to fly him there personally on a bomber to Chanute Air Force Base, or an Air Force Base near Chicago. Chet couldn't remember the name, whereupon Lytle would take a commercial flight up to Chicago. In any case, on this long flight back from Alaska to Illinois, the subject of UFOs came up. There had been a number of UFO sightings near Elmendorf Air Force Base in Alaska, sightings by our bomber crews up there. In the course of discussing those sightings, according to Lytle, General Blanchard suddenly admitted that while he was the base commander at Roswell Army Airfield, he was involved in the recovery of a crashed alien spaceship. And it's doubtful that Lytle may have even heard about it back in 1953, given that after the flurry of activity in July of 47, the Army Air Force quickly changed its story and said this was a weather balloon and so on. We all know that story. So by the time, 6 years later, it's doubtful that the average American, including Lytle, was aware of the facts surrounding the Roswell case in general. So he was quite startled to hear General Blanchard admit all of this. In any case, according to Lytle, Blanchard said that four alien bodies, humanoid bodies, had been recovered, and that this, in fact, had taken place. Now, at that time, Chet Lytle, in his capacity as weapons stockpiling supervisor for the Atomic Energy Commission, his office was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Uh-huh.
And so he was at the right place at the right time to learn additional information. He told me that he wouldn't name these individuals other than Blanchard. He referenced four or five other persons who gave him tidbits of information, but he refused to identify any of those persons, despite my repeated efforts to get the names. But he said that he was told by another high-level reliable source that the bodies were, some of the bodies, quote-unquote, were initially sent to Muroc Air Force Base, California. That's now Edwards Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
But that they all eventually wound up, quote-unquote, wound up at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Actually, it was Wright Field at the time in 47. In any case, Lytle told me also that his military aide, his Air Force aide, that more or less assisted him in his duties, his military liaison duties at Wright-Patt, this individual's wife was the secretary for the general at Wright-Patt, whose job was to guard the bodies. And so he was periodically getting tidbits from people associated with what was going on over there. He said that he was privy to leaks from persons who had seen the autopsies, knew that autopsies on the bodies were taking place. He further said that the craft itself, the crash craft, was located in, he said, Hangar 5. We've all heard about Hangar 18 in Roswell. Lytle claimed that it was Hangar 5 that had the actual debris from the spacecraft, and further said that he was heavily cleared. He told me, quote, this is almost word for word, I was heavily cleared to do the work I did with weapons stockpiling, but I was never allowed into that area. So what I emphasize in my book in discussing all of this, and I will right now also, is that there are no declassified documents to corroborate any of this. There are no independent eyewitnesses to substantiate the conversation he had with Blanchard. But given Lytle's track record, his professional background, and so forth, I consider him a highly credible source. Now, this conversation took place in September of 1998, and 3 years later, I had some information came my way that I wanted to follow up on and pursue with him. So I called him up in November of 2001 and asked him if I could get some additional details on this story about Roswell. And he was extremely reluctant. His whole manner was very curt, and he reluctantly agreed to sit down with me again a second time. When I showed up at his office, I attempted to clip the microphone onto his lapel again, and he said, "We're not going to tape this." And I was puzzled, and I said, you know, reminded him that he had talked to me for nearly 2 hours, 3 years previously. And he let out this big breath, this deep sigh, and drummed his fingers on his desktop and looked me in the eye and said, "After you and I talked, I was paid a visit. And someone wanted to know why I was talking to you and Don Schmidt." And, you know, I said, you know, who will you tell me who this person was? He would not. I said, "Will you tell me at least the agency or department of the government that they were affiliated with?" He would not. And so he was basically deflecting all of my questions about what had taken place. And he finally said, I've spent decades building my business here, and I just don't want to take any chances." And so apparently someone leaned on him.
They got to him.
And so that's where the matter lay. And I moved out of state for 3 years, and it wasn't until 2006 that I contacted his company and found out that he had passed away 2 years previously. And I had a very cordial conversation with his son about this conversation I had had with his late father. And I said, "I want to send you this summary of my interview with him, and I'd like you to review it." And he was quite cordial, quite friendly. However, the next time I called, he refused to take my calls and has subsequently refused to take my calls.
Really? Was he aware prior to you talking to him about it, about what his father experienced?
If he was, he did not drop any hint of that in the conversation that we had. So I don't know the answer to that, to be honest.
Robert, have you ever been threatened?
Well, as I've explained in the past, I think we discussed this when I was on the program back in February. I went out on the college lecture circuit with my program on UFO activity at nuclear weapons sites in September of 81. And by December of 81, I was getting some international publicity in the media. And by February, I started having strange problems with my telephone. And around that same time, I linked up with a now-deceased researcher named Todd Zeckel. Todd Zeckel, some of your listeners will know the name. He was involved in a lawsuit against the Central Intelligence Agency back in the 70s to get some of their documents on UFOs declassified. In any case, Todd and I hooked up around January or February of 82. And in the course of a number of our conversations where we were trading notes and, you know, sharing information, suddenly we would get this strange high-pitched sound, extremely loud, and then the phone would go dead. And this happened repeatedly, variations on that. It never happened at any other time when I was talking to anyone, friends, family, strangers, just Todd and I. And similar problems began occurring when I would contact military sources and interview them over the phone within sometimes 5 minutes, sometimes an hour, sometimes 24 hours after those conversations. I would get a call where somebody would be on the other end not speaking for about 30 seconds, and they'd hang the phone up. And that has basically been a fixture, variations on that, since the early 1980s. So that is the kind of harassment that I've experienced. I did have someone
Let's talk a little bit more about that, Robert, when we come back. And these apparent UFO visitations at nuke sites next on Coast to Coast AM. With our special guest, Robert Hastings, tonight on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Daryl Sims joins us. He's called the Alien Hunter. Guess what we'll be talking about? Let's take calls, though, with Robert Hastings and continue talking about UFOs and nukes on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, you're talking about these possible visitations or threats. You had a couple more points, and then let's talk about the nuke sites. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that in 1985, I got a tip from a former Air Force security guard who, it turns out, worked out at Area 51. He didn't mention the name of the facility, but he just happened to say, you ought to check into this facility out in the desert, which I had never heard about. And a couple weeks later, I was speaking at University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and I happened, during the question and answer session, mentioned cryptically this information that was related to me, and I knew there were people from Nellis Air Force Base in the audience. So I said, I'm curious about this rumor. I don't want anybody to violate a security oath, but if anyone wants to talk to me about that, I'm all ears. Well, no one came up and talked to me except my student sponsor, who said, my dad works at Nellis. He's here tonight, and he wanted me to tell you that the base commander was in the back row.
I love it.
So, coincidentally or not, the next day, for about 8 hours, a heavy-set man driving a white Chevy followed me all around Las Vegas quite openly, and presumably on orders. He quite clearly was ordered to let me know that I was, that he was there, and I think they thought I was going to try to meet with someone to get information about Area 51. I don't know, but that actually happened. But other than that, and a lesser dramatic, not as dramatic incident, the first year I went out on the lecture circuit, the only problems I really had are telephone and email issues.
Tell me why these UFOs that have been seen, spotted all over this planet near nuke sites, why are they showing up there?
Well, first of all, it is going on. There are declassified documents going back to January of 1949, at least that early, talking about UFO activity up at the Los Alamos lab in New Mexico, where the atomic bomb was invented. Other documents indicate that UFOs have been at every principal nuclear laboratory in the 40s and 50s, in the 50s, I should say, Oak Ridge, Hanford site, Savannah River. I mean, it's across the board. And I now know from witnesses that this type of activity occurred at the atomic test site up in Nevada, the Nevada test site. And then later in the 60s, when nuclear missiles came into play, these incidents were going on at ICBM sites, nuclear missile sites, where objects, disc-shaped objects, would come in and hover over either launch control facilities or the missile silos themselves. And as we've discussed, and probably many of your listeners know, there are now a number of retired Air Force personnel, launch officers, whom I've interviewed at various bases, who said that their missiles actually malfunctioned precisely at a time when these UFOs were hovering over their nukes. I have a 600-page book, UFOs and Nukes, devoted to that information, interview after interview after interview with these people, three of whom appeared with me on Larry King about a year ago. Now, that's all factual. The question is why. I am of the opinion that whoever are flying these craft are interested in sending a signal to both Washington and Moscow, the nuclear powers in general, that having nuclear weapons is not healthy for the human race or the planet. And I think what is going on is a covert, in the sense that the public in general is unaware of these things, by and large, but the military, the people in the Pentagon, the CIA, the Kremlin know it's going on, and it's been going on decade after decade after decade. And in my view, and this opinion is shared by three-quarters of my over 100 now, 120 ex-military sources whom I've interviewed, we believe that someone is in effect wagging a finger at humankind, at the nuclear powers, saying, get rid of your nukes. Now, that is purely speculative on my part, but I believe that's a viable scenario given the available facts.
Why would they care about whether we blow ourselves up, Robert? I always assumed maybe these atomic explosions do something to the universe, basically. They do something that affects them.
I think that's entirely within the realm of possibility. Again, it's anyone who says they know the answer is blowing smoke.
Sure.
I mean, I doubt that the people in the Pentagon and the CIA are even, confident that they know the answer. But let's look at the number of scenarios. You've got, first of all, they're protecting themselves in some way. Physics has gotten so complicated in recent years. What used to be fairly straightforward about how the universe was organized and how it worked has kind of been turned on its head. And if anyone's familiar with string theory and parallel universes and all sorts of current ideas that the theoretical physicists are now putting out, it's quite possible that these beings are much closer to our part of the universe than one would suspect by virtue of parallel dimensions and all sorts of things like that. I'm not going to attempt to technically explain them. So your point, in short, is certainly well within the realm of possibility. I prefer to think in terms of whoever these guys are, whoever these beings are, they have a moral sense. They're looking at a savage planet that has the potential of destroying itself, the species, humans that run the show here. And they're, in effect, trying to guide us through our teenage years, our adolescence, so we can emerge on the other side intact and take our place in the community of intelligent races within our galaxy. That's one possibility. But I also point out to my lecture audiences is it's in, you know, within the realm of possibility that whoever they are planning to invade Earth, and they don't want to inherit a radioactive wasteland.
That's, you know, a good possibility.
I mean, too. No one knows. And, you know, like I said, there's lots of potential explanations. But the activity is so well documented. You know, the number of sources that are now coming forward and talking about this. I am hoping within a year's time to organize, I'm not going to go into details, but a press conference at the National Press Club, at which time there will be somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 former or retired Air Force personnel who will divulge all of this to the international media. And hopefully this will get the ball rolling in terms of some sort of disclosure process. That's the fond hope, anyway.
All right, let's go to some of the calls. We'll go to Tucson, Arizona. Johnny, you're up with us on Coast to Coast.
It's a pleasure to join you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It's okay, here's the deal. I lived in SoCal. I lived in the greater Los Angeles area for a long, long time. And I lived next door to a gentleman who worked for the government. And about three times a year, there'd be these crisp, uniformed people that would come to my door and ask me questions about this man. You know, does he party? Is there police action? Is there stuff going on there? Blah, blah, blah. After a while, I got a little curious, and I started asking him questions. And I said, I'd always tell the military, yeah, he's the greatest guy in the world. You know, he's totally straight as an arrow. But after a while, I started asking him questions. We'd sit around in the summer and listen to the Beach Boys and have a beer in the backyard and stuff. And I started asking him questions about Area 51. And I'd say, listen, if you can't answer the question, just smile and wink. But if you can answer, you know, answer. And so he'd say, okay, cool. So I said, is there Area 51? And he said, yes. I said, have you been there? He goes, yes. I go, how'd you get there? He goes, in a van with no windows and no way to see where you're going, and it's secret, and they just take you in there, and you get in there. I said, well, that's really interesting. Okay, cool. And he said, but you know what? You know what's more interesting than Area 51 is Area 58. And I don't know if you guys have ever heard of this, but this is like the new generation of UFO stuff, is Area 58. So I don't know if he was just blowing smoke. I don't think he was, because he was a real straight shooter. But, you know, this was a really, really interesting aspect of this whole dimension.
All right, very good. Fascinating. Has the Chernobyl episode and a UFO that was reported over that area been a story that you investigated, Robert?
I didn't investigate that, but in one of the appendices in my book, I do discuss sightings at civilian nuclear power plants. And for those listeners not knowing what we're talking about here, the Soviet Ukraine, in April of 1986, one of their reactors exploded, the Chernobyl plant. And what has emerged just within the last 10 years are stories from persons who were involved in monitoring radiation for the Soviet government who were sent to the site within hours of the explosion to monitor radiation levels. And the stories that have been reported, I think probably in the early 90s, I'd have to look at the book, but within the last 10 years, there have been stories in Pravda and in the Ukrainian media where these radiation monitoring teams have described seeing a brass-colored object, reddish-orange, let's call it, bright, fiery object, hovering directly above the Chernobyl plant within hours of the explosion. And what they've told the media over there is that they witnessed beams, two beams of light, crimson in color, emanating, coming down from this round, this spherical UFO, directly into the smoking ruins of the reactor. And the bottom line was they had taken radiation readings prior to the appearance of this object, which I believe from memory were something like, from their position, 800 millirentgens per hour, or excuse me, 3,000 millirentgens per hour. And when the object left, the next time they took readings, they had dropped to 800 millirentgens per hour, a dramatic decrease in the radiation level in the ambient area, the immediate area. For which they had no scientific explanation. And the person giving the interviews said that there were hundreds of witnesses to the appearance of this object. So that's quite a dramatic story, and apparently the sources are legitimate and are bona fide. They're not, you know, crazies making up this story.
Robert, you've done a great job, by the way, investigating this.
Thank you.
Like no one else. UFOs and nukes, that's his work. North Carolina we go. Kinsey, you're up with us. Hi, Kinsey.
Hi there. Good morning, gentlemen. I was actually calling. I've been listening just a couple months now, and I just everything seems connected. I mean, you know, it seems to me like you said earlier that we were seeded. It seems like we were put here, and it's kind of like they're guiding us. They're doing experiments genetically, getting different mutations, different diseases, cures. I mean, it just seems like everything's kind of interconnected.
It sure does, doesn't it, Robert?
I've had a lifelong interest in UFOs. When I was a teenager in the 1960s, there were sightings almost every day that were in the media and so on. As I mentioned in my book, what really kick-started all of this for me was my dad was career Air Force, and he was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 1966 and 67. At the time, some of the incidents involving UFOs shutting down nuclear missiles were taking place. So that's what really sparked my interest in all of this. So while I can speak authoritatively to the nuclear weapons-related cases, beyond that, I think I'm really no more I have no more insight than most people in terms of what's going on. I am of the opinion that what we now call UFOs probably have been around for thousands of years, whether they seeded us here or not, or have just been monitoring humans' development, I don't presume to know. It's pretty fascinating. But I don't think that what has gone on since World War II is certainly out of the blue. I think it's been around for a long, long time. It just so happens that if you look at the general level of UFO activity in the 100 years or so that preceded World War II and the creation of nuclear weapons, the level of activity was fairly modest. And there were periodic reports in the media around the world of what we would now call UFO sightings. But all of that just spiked. It just went exponential right at the time we developed and began to test and deploy and threaten to use in warfare nuclear weapons. And I'm quite convinced that there's a connection.
Okay, let's go to Eddie in Nashville, Tennessee. Go ahead, Eddie.
Yes, Robert, I worked at the Nevada test site for the Lawrence Radiation Laboratory in the early 60s. I had a high Q clearance, which is the highest you can get. And you're one thing you're wrong about, we did all of our own films. We did all of our high-speed films and all our still photography and all that. EG&G was a support group for us. LRL did 80% of the testing. Los Alamos did 20% of the testing out there. And we knew about Roswell in the early 60s. Otto Krauss, a project physicist out there, was in Roswell or in Alamogordo when all that happened. And he's a person that we worked with, and he was telling us about Roswell one night playing hearts. And that wasn't the real issue. The real issue was I grew up in Farmington, New Mexico, and the crash that we got at Aztec was the one that was taking the Hangar 18. It had a pinhole in the porthole, and there were three charred bodies inside, about 4 foot high in stature. And that's the one that took them 3 weeks to get into the craft to figure out how to get into it. And, I was in Hart Canyon 2 days after they took that craft out of there, and I can tell you there were truck tracks everywhere out there, and normally you'd see a Jeep track out there once in a while. But a friend of mine and I rode our horses out there because there was an article in the paper about it, and then the article disappeared. They come out and said it was a hoax the next day, and everybody in Farmington could remember the article about the hoax. Nobody remembers the article about the crash at Hart Canyon.
Okay, well, I can't address that. I don't know about that. I do know for a fact, not only from Chattel Idol, but that EG&G was indeed contracted to do films in the late 40s and early 50s. You said you were at the Nevada test site, I believe, in the 1960s.
Yeah.
So jurisdiction may, in fact, have changed. I wouldn't presume to know that, but I do know from sources independent of Idol that EG&G was given film contract. Not only for Nevada, but the Pacific test sites down at Eniwetok and Kwajalein.
They did most of the photography over in Area 51.
Okay,
but as far as in the test site itself, we did all of our own. We were over in Area 51 at times, and the guy that called in earlier.
Sir, my
right.
point, you were there in the 1960s, correct?
And when you went to Area 51,
my point is you were there beginning in the 1960s, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, what I'm saying is
20 seconds left, Robert.
Okay, a decade earlier, there were EG&G contracted pilots in the Nevada test site area and in the South Pacific test areas.
Very good. Robert, once again, thank you so much for the work you've been doing.
Community
needs that, my friend.
I appreciate
Robert
you having me on.
UFOs and nukes, extraordinary encounters at nuclear weapons sites. Don't forget our program tomorrow, of course, will be with Daryl Sims, none other than the alien hunter. For Dave Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.